Welcome to the third installment of the 61st episode of It Wasn't Me, a true crime podcast where we discuss murders that intrigue us. I'm Mercedes.
And I am Cindy. Thank you for listening to last week's episode where we left off with the disappearance of a number of young women from Stockton, California. Listen this week as we continue to discuss the speed freak killers.
Our show is often horrifying and graphic, and we will use offensive language. So if you have kids, put them away for a while and join us for a murder. Also, we are passionate and always have been about true crime, but we must warn you, sometimes we will make jokes and laugh during our podcast.
Want to learn more about us? Visit our website at itwasn'tmetruecrime.com to find links to our social media pages. We drop a new episode every Friday morning. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform so you don't miss out. Thanks for listening. And even if you are slightly entertained by our Southern charm, leave us a 5-star rating along with a comment. If not, reach out to us and let us know how we can improve. Also, please recommend our podcast to your friends and family. Share the love.
Hey, Cindy, how's it going?
It's going all right. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
Yeah.
Another beautiful day. Cold.
Ugh, I know. Yes, it's going to be cold and it's supposed to rain tomorrow. And I have a full day of bleacher ass in store for me.
Well, have fun with that.
Yeah. I need to have fun. I really need to invest in those West Marine boat chairs.
Yeah.
They're like recliners.
Oh, nice.
For the, you know, a lot of people, they're boat chairs, but that I see them at wrestling tournaments.
Sounds heavy.
They don't appear heavy when people are carrying them around.
Okay.
So, but they're thick. They're like $135, but I figure I should go ahead and invest now.
Comfort is awesome.
Because if you don't know about bleacher ass, let me tell you, mine is, there's not a whole lot of cushion there.
Well, take a pillow, I guess.
I will.
Ah. Okay, well, you ready to get started? Hello. All right, so just so you know, this is part 3 of episode 61.
Mm-hmm.
So 61.3, if you haven't listened to 61.1 and 61.2, go ahead, go back, take a listen, and we'll be here when you get back.
Yes, yes. I did recently, before we get started, read that Phil Spector died.
Yes, I saw that.
Yeah, we did an episode on him.
Yes, you did. He's a creepy, creepy dude.
Yes.
And you did another one that kind of looked like him, which is how you got on him. I remember.
Yes.
We digress.
Oh, quite often.
Okay, so go ahead, go back, listen to those. We'll be here when you get back. For those of you who have already listened, I just want to give you a quick review. Between 1985 and 1988, 4 teenagers disappeared from Stockton, California. There was Kimberly Billy, who was 19, Joanne Hobson, who was 16, Chevy Wheeler, who was 16, and Gail Marks, who was 19. In addition, the body of 24-year-old Robin Armtrout was found naked. She had been raped and stabbed to death, and her body had been tossed in Potter's Creek. Police had found no evidence that they could use in any of the disappearances or in Armtrout's murder, but Wes Shermantine's name kept coming up in their investigation. In 1985, police had collected blood and hair samples that they believed to belong to Chevy Wheeler. Those were in his family cabin. DNA technology was not like what it is today. Police had nothing to charge him with, so he remained a free man, living his disgusting life, doing what he loved best, which was hunting the ultimate prey, humans.
Ugh, gross.
Okay, so yeah, and I don't really know. I didn't really follow that. This is a humongous story. So I'm just kind of leaving off in 1988 with the disappearance of Gail Marks. And I'm skipping up to 1998.
Okay.
And the disappearance of another woman. And I'm not saying he didn't commit crimes between that time. But what I'm saying is that I honestly did not take the time because there was nothing that hugely stood out.
Right. Yeah.
So we're going to go to the year 1998 when Tracy Melton disappeared. So on Wednesday, May 6, 1998, in Stockton, California, 32-year-old Tracy Melton, who had 3 children, disappeared and she was never seen again. Her disappearance was a nightmare for her family. She had problems, but she loved her children and she was present in their lives on a daily basis. Her son, who was 11 at the time, and her daughters, who were 6 and 7, did not understand why their mom never came home. She never called. She never said goodbye.
Aww.
Her family had very little hope that she would ever come home because immediately they knew something had happened to her because this wasn't like her. And immediately rumors started going around that she may have been a victim of Wes Shermantine and Lauren Herzog. Tracy knew them and they had partied. She had partied with them before. And her sister said, nobody could find her. They ended up calling authorities, and authorities told them, well, you know, she's missing. She's an adult. We'll just have to wait and see. But, you know, they didn't seem to care. So no real investigation was ever done, according to her family. When the police finally did look into it, they discovered that the last place that she had been seen was at a methadone clinic. She was an addict. And so, of course, you know, they didn't really take much stock in her disappearance after they realized that. They did post on their Facebook page, like one of those missing posts, you know, and they had a picture of her, and they had her height and her eye color, and of course, where she was last seen at the methadone clinic. So, you know, they announced that to everybody.
I just think that that is just, I mean, just because they're methadone, you know, addicted to methadone, because that's what they are.
I mean, what was the point of that? Yeah. What's the point of putting that on your Facebook page if she's missing? I don't get that. Is that important to, you know, I can see why her eye color would be important, or age or height and hair color, but
I mean,
why?
I guess, I don't know. I mean, I guess they would say she was last seen here. So if someone says, hey, I saw her, or I saw her get into a car, but it's just, I mean, right. I see both sides, but couldn't they just say maybe a clinic at such and such address, or what, right. You know, I don't know. I don't know.
To me, it was kind of just like, oh yeah, well, she, you know, like maybe she begged for it or something, right? Basically, police were of absolutely no help. Her family then went to the media about her disappearance, but the media wasn't much help either. You know, they would post things every now and then, but the sister said, they would not help us. We kept looking for her. We conducted our own searches, but we could never find her. You know, they asked around. Her case wasn't publicized, so it just kind of fizzled out. And despite her family's best attempts to shed light on their missing loved one, no one seemed to care about what could have happened to Tracy Melton.
Jeez. So, it's just so sad.
Isn't it? Yeah.
I just really, now, I don't it, know.
It is sad. And how many of these disappearances happen every single day that we don't hear about, unless they're beautiful young women, or, you know, something that can be totally sensationalized?
Well, and, you know, and I'm just as guilty. Like when something happens, I'm like, oh, but she was so beautiful. Not that that matters. You know, it's like if something tragic happens to a pretty person, sometimes like, oh, well, she was just so pretty, or, you know, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if she was had three noses.
Right. Or if she was a drug addict.
Yeah. Right. And truly, I mean, it truly doesn't. Just like, just because you're a sex worker doesn't mean that you deserve to get raped or that you can't say no.
Exactly. Her disappearance didn't create much of a ripple in the headlines, but 6 months later, the disappearance of Cindy Vanderheiden did. Her family moved to the area when Cindy was 4 years old, and this was in Clements. And I looked up the geography of this area. It is rural, and it's, there's like Lodi, there's Stockton, there's Clements. There are all these towns that are all around each other. Mm-hmm. She grew up in Clements, which is the same area as Herzog and Shermantine grew up in. She was a cheerleader. She was popular in the community. She stuck around after she graduated. She was well-known and well-liked. Her dad also owned a couple of businesses there, which I'm going to talk about in just a minute. Her disappearance became big news almost immediately. Her parents knew something was wrong, and they were quick to action. Her dad, John Vanderheiden, owned two bars, and he also owned an HVAC business. Through his bar ownership, that's how he knew Lauren Herzog. He knew Lauren as Slim because he was tall and thin. Herzog was a regular. He often came to the bar several times a week, and occasionally he would come in with his longtime BFF, Wes Shermantine. According to Vanderheiden, Shermantine would brag that he was a killer, and he and Lauren would regale the bar with stories of their golden days and their knowledge of the mine shafts and wells in the area. They bragged that they knew just the places to dump dead bodies. John said that he overheard Shermantine say he knew of a mine shaft that he could throw a body in and it would never be found.
That's frightening.
Yeah, just somebody bragging about it. And Vanderheiden said, you know, at the time, I just figured he's talking out of his drunken ass. You know, he's just one of those arrogant braggers. But when he realized that his daughter had last been seen talking to those two, Shermantine and Herzog, all those stories came back to him about, you know, how they were bragging, and his disbelief turned to terror. It was then that he remembered not only the boasting death tales of the two men, but he also remembered some of the rumors and the suspicious disappearances of the other young women in the area. He also knew at that moment that those two were responsible for his daughter's disappearance.
Baby.
A week before her disappearance, Cindy had her 25th birthday, and her parents were able to pull off a surprise birthday surprise at one of their bars. According to one source, when Cindy showed up, she got really, really pissed off because she looked like shit. She didn't have makeup on. Her hair was thrown up in a baseball cap. You know, she was just wearing grubby clothes. Mm-hmm. And she thought she was just running an errand for one of her parents, but it turned out like all these people were there. She got over it pretty quickly. I mean, before long, she was posing in pictures and she was smiling and looked happy.
Well, good.
In one article, it said that in one photo, she's standing beside her dad. They're singing karaoke. Each of them is holding a microphone. She was a former high school cheerleader. I told you that. She was nicknamed Tigger because she was bouncy and energetic. And according to another source, she had experienced some recent rough patches, but she was doing well for herself. And I don't know what that means, but as a former young 20 something, I know that I've had some rough patches. So I don't know what those rough patches were. I didn't delve too deeply into them, but whatever. She had a job. She saved up enough money to get her own brand new car.
Nice.
She just started a new job that she was super excited about. And she was living at home. She was made her bed every day. I mean, her mom had a nag at her, but she made her bed every day.
Yeah.
25, she was loving life. She was having a great time. And she had so much fun at her surprise party that she asked her parents if they wanted to go to karaoke with her that night. And they're like, no, you know, we're really tired. We're going to go home and go to bed early. Well, she ended up going out with another friend. They met at her father's bar that was in Clements, and they rode together to her dad's other bar, the Linden Inn. And there the two were partying. They were singing karaoke. They were having a good time. And at one point, Cindy begins talking to Shermantine and Herzog, and they hang out there until the bars close. When Cindy leaves, her friend takes her to her car at the other bar, and her friend then follows Cindy to her home. Her friend saw Cindy pull into the driveway, and then the friend just kept driving. So the friend saw her safely into the driveway, but didn't wait to see if she went inside.
That person's never going to forget that.
Well, and you know, her parents, that she asked them to go karaoke, and they said no. I mean, can you imagine living with that?
No.
You know, there are so many what ifs. What if we would have done this? But that wasn't fate. That's not what happened. So you can't, but you're always going to have that in your mind. Always. So the next morning, her mom, Teresa Vanderheiden, remembers that she peeked into Cindy's room and was pleasantly surprised because her daughter's bed was made. Because usually Cindy would take off in the morning without making her bed. So Teresa was like, oh, awesome. I didn't have to say a word to her. And then she left and went to work.
I probably would have been like, But if she harps on her every morning about that, then maybe she didn't think anything of it.
Yeah.
Like finally, she turns 25 and woo.
Yeah. Making her bed. So later that morning, her dad was on his way to one of his HVAC jobs, and he passed the Clements Glenview Cemetery and saw his daughter's brand new gold car sitting in the middle of the deserted parking lot.
Oh, hell no.
And he's like, okay, what the hell is her car doing in the parking lot? He contacted his wife and he's like, what's Cindy's car is in the cemetery. So they called her work and found out that she never made it to her job that morning. And that was like, no, she was excited about that job. She would never not show up for that job. So he turned around and went right back to inspect her car. He found that her black purse and her cigarettes were in the back seat, and her cell phone was on the center console, but her keys were not in anywhere to be found. On November 15, 1998, as soon as they saw that, they realized that, they reported her missing. So she hadn't even been missing for 24 hours, as far as they knew.
Do you know if the police gave them a hard time? Because
I don't think so. I did not see anything. Like, these people were insistent, and, you know, they were respected enough to where, you know, there's something going on here.
Which is sad that they took that.
Yes. Tracy Melton's headlines didn't go anywhere because of that. But she was also from Stockton, and this was in Clements.
True.
So it was different law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So she's missing. Police have been called. And on November 22nd, community organizes hundreds of people to search for her. Mm-hmm. Her sister returns to California from Wyoming. She basically took charge of the search party, I guess. They got phones installed and fax machines. You know, they were determined not to let her simply disappear.
Yeah. 100%.
By the next day, more than 50 people were looking for her. And then within a week, they said that number had more than tripled. There were friends and strangers searching. People were looking by foot, by helicopter, by horseback, and they had Harleys out. Friends held fundraisers. I mean, everybody was involved.
Wow.
And meanwhile, the San Joaquin County Sheriff's investigators started watching Shermantine and Herzog because, and I'll get to this in a minute, but mm-hmm. they immediately came up.
Yeah.
Because, of course, you know, they're asking witnesses who was last to see her. And
well, and just they have a history and they just haven't been able. And plus, part of me kind of thinks they were like, well, this sounds like their MO and we haven't been able to nail them on anything now. So we're going to look at them first just in case.
Exactly.
Because we want to nail their asses. So we're going to.
Right. Because they already.
That wouldn't be fair, but.
And they know that Shermantine is responsible for Chevy Wheeler. They just don't have the evidence. So they are looking anywhere. You know, anytime they hear a rumor, you know, these guys know the area. They were seen on such and such mm-hmm. a road. I mean, they were looking anywhere they could to find something to hold these guys on. Investigators search hillsides, riverbeds, mine shafts. Anything where these guys had explored as children. The lead investigator, Deborah Scheffel, recalled that there are about 47,000 registered mine shafts within traveling distance from where Cindy disappeared.
Holy crap.
47,000 registered. Okay. She added that there were air shafts and unregistered mines, and then the number is likely doubled. Some of those were as big as a house and 90 feet deep straight down, which pose challenges and risks for searchers.
Well, that's what I was going to say. The registered ones mm-hmm. might be safe, you know, because then they know this one's safe, this one's not safe, or, you know, or
right.
Like, but those ones that aren't registered, there's no telling. Like, yeah, we know it's there, but I mean, I don't know. I just.
Yeah. One property owner was dumping trash in a deep mine shaft and then burning it once a year. So any, you know, who knows with that?
Seems legal.
Okay. So also remember the hair and blood samples collected from the Shermantine family cabin in 1985 that they yes. I talked about, and DNA testing had come a long way since 1985. So the investigators mm-hmm. were like, hey, you know what? Let's send that shit in. Maybe we'll get a match.
Fantastic.
In addition, they had gotten samples of blood from Cindy or from Cindy's parents so that they would have that on file because they're like grasping at anything. You know what? Yeah. This might come in handy later. The massive search for her had received its share of publicity. And so the idea of serial killers in this area exploded in the media. And every single case in national news in the state of California, you know, they're all looking at, okay, could Shermantine or Herzog been involved in this? Mm-hmm. But I'm going to actually talk to you about some high profile cases that they were looked at for in next week's episode.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm going to stop for now. This is a good time to tell you about this week's sponsor.
Hey, everybody. It's that time. Take a minute to tell you about this week's sponsor, Best Fiends. As you all know, researching criminal cases is my passion, but even I need an occasional break. So when I feel like I need to escape to a simpler world, I always turn to the mobile puzzle game, Best Fiends. If you haven't heard, Best Fiends is a puzzle game that you can play right on your phone. Each level has challenging puzzles that you have to solve, and they actually engage your brain. No worries at all, because it's a casual, relaxing game that anyone can play, and it's really, really fun. See, Best Fiends are these adorable little characters who are tasked with saving Minutia from the slugs who are rampaging across the land, rounding up Best Fiend families, and glooping up the countryside. This is a vibrant and creative world with almost 40 unique fiends in the Best Fiends world. Even better, new fiends are added all the time. My goal is to collect them all, so I always check back the newest additions to the family. This week, let me tell you about Pop, an axolotl from Mushroom Village. This sweet girl crawled out of the ominous ocean and never looked back. I mean, who wouldn't want to have legs and fins? This coral-haired amphibian has your back as long as you don't call her a fish. I love finding a new favorite character to spotlight each month. Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old. So, true crime-loving listeners, join us and the millions of others who love this app. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends.
Alrighty, thank you. Thank you.
Back to the show, as one of our guys says. Okay. In 1985, investigators served the search warrant on the Shermantine remote cabin and found the blood and hair samples. Mm-hmm. And at that time, DNA testing was not a thing. But like I said, they were preserved. And when the technology advanced, they decided, let's send those bitches in. So they did that in April of 1998. And it came back as being tested positive for Chevy Wheeler's blood. Right. So this allowed police to bring Herzog and Shermantine in for questioning for the disappearance and probable murder of Chevy Wheeler and the disappearance and probable murder of Cindy Vanderheiden.
Wow.
Now, during his interview, Shermantine didn't reveal much. You know, he's like, whatever, I'm lawyering up his, and he left and went about his business. Now
is his mommy the one that drove the bulldozer into the house?
Yes, it is. And he's also the one that had been exonerated for raping and sodomizing that woman in San Andreas, I think. I can't even remember where now. That was last episode that I told you about that. Mm-hmm. And he was acquitted for it. He's been down this road before. So he's got a little experience in dealing with law enforcement. Herzog, on the other hand, remember, he'd only gotten a citation for like noise ordinance. Noise ordinance citation. So he had never been in trouble before.
Hopefully he started.
Oh, he blabbed, honey. Okay. He was interrogated for more than 17 hours. Basically, he implicated Shermantine in 5 unsolved murders in Northern California, as well as the shooting death of a hunter in Utah in 1994. Any loyalty that he had towards his lifelong friend Shermantine was absolutely gone during this interrogation. And you notice I said 17 hours. That's gonna come back later.
Awesome. I'll tell you about that
next week. Okay. They did videotape these this interrogation. Everything is on videotape. I've actually watched some of it. You can YouTube it. But he was interrogated for 17 hours, as I said, by sheriff's detectives. And
yeah, I would just put my head down and go to sleep.
Yeah.
I'd be like,
Yeah, well, first of all, he's only in there for questioning. So he has the right to an attorney. He has the right to leave.
I'll be like, peace.
Right. But I don't know. Like I said, I did not watch all 17 hours of this videotape. I watched about 3 or 4 minutes of it, and it was horrific.
Maybe he was like, oh, finally, I can tell somebody.
Well, and that's too what I was kind of thinking, but, you know, he's whatever. He's a murderer or, you know, convicted murderer, definitely. I haven't gotten that far yet, but he told a story of knowing Shermantine. They had known each other since, you know, before school. They were childhood friends, and he said, you know what, we killed for sport. Said even at a very young age, he told investigators that Shermantine shot out the eye of his family's cat, and they both found the incident hilarious. Like, they laughed. Told investigators that they would discuss methods of killing, and they would just speculate on what would happen if you shot such and such with, you know, this type of gun. So they would experiment. They would shoot dogs and cats. They even shot a cow just to see what would happen with different weapons. He also discussed, well, let's see what this gunshot blast will do. Let's see what this pistol will do.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like them. Okay. Even a cow? What's wrong with these people?
Okay, but what about the women? Yeah.
I know that too. I mean, no. I know that too. But just, I don't know, just to like.
Yeah, were pure evil.
And yeah, that's a new level of.
Yeah.
Fucking demented.
It kind of reminds me of The Most Dangerous Game, that short story.
Yes.
Have you ever read that?
Yeah. Yes, where they are on the island and
there's
a movie kind of like it.
There is a movie called The Most Dangerous Game, yes.
Right, right. But then there's, is that the one with...
There's one with a rock in it, isn't it? A new one.
There's a few movies that are kind of like that, but the one where they're prisoners, there's one that where they release the prisoners on the island.
Oh.
With the hopes of like being able to get their freedom, but really they're just being hunted for sport.
Interesting. I don't know that one.
Wow. Yeah.
All right. So during this interrogation, he also told investigators about a few of Shermantine's murders, including details of Cindy's murder. So at this point, there are no hopes that she's still alive. Like, now they know she's dead. According to Herzog, on the night that Cindy Vanderheiden was murdered, Shermantine and Cindy were partying in a bar. Now, you know, he says Shermantine and Cindy were partying at a bar, but all three of them were. They were all partying at the bar. And Herzog said that Shermantine and Cindy had made arrangements to meet at the cemetery later that night because she wanted to do some drugs.
That sounds like a terrible idea.
Well, her family, they don't believe this. And I'm going to tell you that at a later slide. But this is his story, what he said during the video.
When we went to Atlanta.
Okay.
If I went missing and someone told my husband that, oh yeah, Cindy said she was going to meet me in a cemetery to do some drugs, 100% my husband would be like, no, the fuck she wouldn't. Right. You know, like, that bitch is not meeting you in a cemetery. No. God, that's so...
Well, we know that she did go to the cemetery because her car was there. Yeah. But we...
Oh, but...
Or there? Well, it could be, you know, I read in one article, they believe that she was, and I didn't put that in here, but somebody believed that she had been abducted and the other one of them drove her car.
Yeah.
But there's no evidence of that. There's no evidence that I read that anyone had driven her car by her.
Let the record show that if my car is ever found in a cemetery and someone says, well, we met there last night after partying in a bar and we were going to do some drugs, they're fucking lying. Pardon my language. Sorry.
All right. So let me tell you what happened when he said that they met there.
Okay.
He said that once they all got there, she jumped into the front passenger seat because he himself was in the back. And Shermantine was in the front.
She went from the driver's seat to the passenger seat.
So Shermantine, she got out of her car and got into Shermantine's car.
Gotcha. Okay.
Okay. So she's sitting in the passenger seat up front. Herzog's in the back and Shermantine's in the front in the driver's seat. And they did some meth. Herzog said that then Shermantine started driving off, just taking them on a wild trip. And that's quotation marks. On a wild trip through the back roads when Cindy started getting scared and she demands to go back to her car. Herzog said then Shermantine started making sexual demands of her and she refused. And Herzog said she talked back to him and demanded that he take her back to her car. And then Shermantine pulled a knife on her and forced her to perform oral sex on him as he's speeding down the county roads.
And I would bite your penis off.
Now, mind you, that Herzog is in the back seat and according to him, Shermantine then stops on Waverly Road, and I don't know if it's because she bit him. I don't know. But he stops the car, and he gets out, and he rapes her, and he sodomizes her, and he threatens, he says, I'll cut your throat. Herzog says that Shermantine then stopped the car. Okay, I already said that. And Herzog said, well, he's getting wilder and wilder and wound up and more, and I told him at one point, I said, Wes, don't kill her, man. And this is the part I saw.
Uh-huh.
And Herzog said that Shermantine refused, saying she'll tell on us. And Herzog said, well, what do you mean us? Take her back to her car. Like, I'm sure he really said that, right?
Yeah.
And here are some more of the gruesome details from this interview. He said that Shermantine was raping Cindy when Herzog heard the click of the knife blade opening and locking in place. And then Herzog's like, yeah, I started getting out of the car then, but it was already too late because he's already slashing and hacking, man.
Oh my God. Okay. So I have a question. And if you have covered this, I am sincerely apologizing, but is Herzog, is he actively participating in the murders?
This is him on the videotape.
Right. Okay. So he's saying that he didn't.
This is why he's telling police. This is like the police are getting an idea of what could have happened here.
Okay.
But do the police believe that he's involved? They do. They do believe that
Okay, but he's trying to play it off. He's
playing it off as blaming Shermantine.
Okay.
Okay, and then guess what defense Shermantine's attorney is going to use?
Insane?
No, I'll get to that in a few minutes. Then Herzog said, oh, she was tough. She's tougher than I am, I think, but I don't know. I guess he must have been having a hard time killing her. For more than 10 minutes, Vanderheiden fought furiously for her life, arguing, fighting, begging, and praying. And Herzog said that finally, Shermantine put his knee on her chest and made a chilling statement. Herzog said, it must have been towards the end. I can remember he said, just let it come natural. I guess he meant dying, you know. So he's like so matter of fact.
This is not fucking natural. If it was natural, you wouldn't have to fucking murder me.
When the interrogator asked Herzog if Cindy was saying anything during this ordeal, he said, yeah, he was asking Shermantine not to kill her. And then he was asking me to help her. Herzog said that she was calling his nickname Slim. Slim, help me. Slim, do something. And then Herzog just admitted that he didn't help her. Instead, he just like laid down in the backseat of the car and turned away from her.
Oh, I'm just going to take a nap.
Yeah.
I hate him.
And basically, yeah, that's what he says. The investigators and the Vanderheidens did not buy Herzog's story of what happened at all. I mean, for one thing, Cindy had to go to work the next day at the job that she loved, and she was trying to move up in. Highly unlikely that she would stay out all night doing meth. Also, why would she drive home first, pretend to pull into the driveway instead of just going directly to the cemetery after leaving the bar? They believe, like I said, that she was followed and abducted while she was in her driveway. Whatever the case, Herzog's own words were enough for investigators to charge him with murder. Plus, the description of what happened to Cindy in the car matched with blood evidence that was later found in Shermantine's car, which I'll get to later.
God, I swear, I pray to God that nothing ever like this. I mean, I wish that no one ever experienced something like this, but this is just so fucking disturbing.
It's awful.
They're all disturbing. But I guess in this situation, it's like more like this could happen to anyone.
Well, absolutely. And the fact that, you know, these guys got away with it for so long. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more next week, because there's a reason why all this time he's getting away with doing this.
Oh, fuckers. Well, I mean, it's just like we went out to our little wine place that we love to go to, which we need to go to very soon. And then we went to that little CD place around the corner. And remember, I lost my little wallet. And
right.
I went, you know, and I went all the way across town, went back to it all by my lonesome. I mean, granted, luckily there was some, you know, there were a couple of people there that we knew from just our small town. But that could have, I mean, I'm just like thinking, I'm like, that could easily happen to, I mean.
Yes, it could. Any of us,
first of all,
at any time, right?
I'm gonna talk shit to the bitter end. So,
well, and the thing is that, you know, that he dated her sister, which I'll get to. She trusted him, she knew him, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. Now Herzog continued to sing. That's not all he told investigators. I mean, he gave them a lot of stuff in 17 hours. He told them that he only watched Shermantine commit these murders. He said that Shermantine had bragged over the years of murdering as many as 24 people. He told detectives that Shermantine either pulled the trigger or wielded the knife in every single murder that they were charged with, and they're charged with four. I'll tell you about those later. Herzog told investigators about that the two would ride in a truck when they and shoot things. And he said one time they passed a parked 1982 Pontiac and they decided, hey, let's have some fun. And they turned the truck around and each of them pulled a shotgun. And Herzog said that Shermantine fired first at the driver and killed him. And I told you about this first episode of this, which was Howard Michael King. And then he walked around to the other side and dragged Paul Raymond Cavanaugh out from the passenger door and shot him. Later, it was determined that each one of the guys killed one of the guys. So they each had a victim in that. But they were charged with those two murders. And then 2 months before that, Herzog said that they were driving on Highway 88 when they passed Henry Howell, a 41-year-old who was drunk and parked along the side of the road. And Shermantine stopped, got out of the truck and shot him. And then Herzog also said he told the police that in September 1985, they picked up 24-year-old Robin Armtrout at a park near Delmar Avenue in Stockton.
Mm-hmm.
And they told her they were going to go drinking together. Instead, they took her to a country pasture just east of where they grew up. And Herzog said Shermantine got carried away and he beat, raped, and eventually stabbed her more than a dozen times before they left her naked on the bank of a creek. She was actually stabbed like 45 times.
That takes like some.
It does. And, and they found her body. The thing is that they were never, I don't believe they were ever charged with her. They were never charged or convicted with her murder.
Of course they weren't.
All right. He also, Herzog said that Shermantine also bragged about doing the same thing to Chevy Wheeler in 1985.
So many years, 14 years.
Yeah. So Herzog's just letting it all spill out. Investigators are just like, oh, this is a gold mine. I mean, I'm not stopping this guy from talking now. I mean, why would you?
Why would they? Yeah.
Investigators, remember, knew that Shermantine was responsible for Chevy's disappearance, but they just never had enough evidence. And now, guess what? They have plenty, because not only did Herzog say that Shermantine did it, but now they had the DNA evidence to prove it. Mm-hmm.
DNA and a witness, whether he,
I don't know if it'd be a witness. It's hearsay, yeah. Isn't it? Would it be hearsay if Herzog said, yeah, he told me, or no? It would be hearsay, yeah. if somebody else told him.
Well, I guess if he wasn't with him, technically it would be hearsay, but if he was just testifying against him because he was there.
Now, Hearst also implicated Shermantine in the 1994 shooting of a hunter in northern Utah when the two went there for a hunting trip. Now, mm-hmm. Utah officials were investigating the unsolved murder of a hunter from 1994, but there are no charges have ever been filed in that case because, of course, there's not enough evidence.
Right. But if he's offering him up, then that's probably him.
Right. So they just don't have, you know, still the DA is not going to take it based on one guy's word who's yeah. That's not true for the Vanderheiden case, though, because on March 18th, 1999, Wes Shermantine and Lauren Herzog were 33 years old now, were arrested for the murder of Cindy Vanderheiden. And they were finally brought to trial on November 22nd, 2000, which was about 2 years after she vanished. Her body, none of those bodies have ever been found. Chevy nor Cindy have been found.
God, are they probably in one of those 45,000 plus mine shafts?
Well, at the time of the trial. So they're trying this with no bodies.
Okay. Which has been done before.
Yes, absolutely. 2 years from after she disappeared, the two were brought to trial in Santa Clara County because, of course, you know, there's too much publicity in their own county. So change of venue.
Mm-hmm. Which a change of venue is a pain in the ass.
It is. It is, but you know, there was nothing they could do.
I mean, that's all right. Yeah. In the Ted Bundy case, they went all the way to Miami, like here in Florida.
Yeah.
So he killed the girls in Tallahassee. Then he killed Kimberly Leach in Lake City. And so they had to go all the way to Miami to try him.
That's pretty far.
I mean, from here it is.
From even Lake City, it is.
Yeah. I mean, but you couldn't escape.
And y'all, if y'all have never been to Lake City, it's just a place you have to check out. Okay.
You got to check out the Busy Bee, man.
I think it might have a plaza there.
They have the worst coffee shop in the world. It's gross.
Okay. All right. We already have weirdos coming after us. Let's not add to the mix. Okay. All right. On November 22nd, 2000, the trial Wes Shermantine began with the prosecutor painting a picture of a ruthless predator. Now that's direct quote on a 15-year long rampage. That's like
your favorite word, but you know what? This is a heinous crime.
It is a heinous crime. He was charged with killing three people in the 1980s and a woman in 1998. So at the time, only two of the bodies had been found, as I said. During the course of the trial, the prosecution called several witnesses who testified that they had been brutalized by Shermantine. I did tell you a little bit about this during the first episode. Mm-hmm. Five women testified that he had violently raped or sodomized them, including the babysitter of his own children. She said that she went by his house, dropped by to pick up money that he owed her, and he attacked her.
Oh, I forgot this sicko was married.
Mm-hmm. Another woman testified that he had rear-ended her and he kidnapped her when she pulled off the road to exchange insurance information. He like pulled a knife on her and threw her in the car, but she jumped out of the car while it was moving and managed to get away. Now, what I don't understand is how the hell he got away with that one. Like, did she call law enforcement at that point? I don't know. His own wife testified against him. Now, they had been separated at the time, but she described in detail how she had been brutally beaten for years. He would hit her when she was pregnant. He would hit her, beat her while she was holding the babies in her lap.
He'd get Earl'd.
Yeah, she, you know, and I don't know, just based on my perspective of her, she was kind of browbeaten or, you know, she was definitely
battered women syndrome.
She was just probably on eggshells all the time, just frightened to do anything.
God bless her heart.
The prosecutor also showed the jury the famous parts of the famed video that Herzog, you know, the videotape of his interrogation. And according to one source, Herzog said Vanderheiden wanted to party the November night that he and the jury watched. According to one source, Herzog, after he said that he wanted to party that November night, the jury watched the video. They were mesmerized as he revealed details of the murder that he says he did not participate in. Vanderheiden's sister, Kim, who used to date him, wept while she watched the videotape. And her dad just sat there watching it because, you know, they hadn't seen it before. It was shown in court.
So Vanderheiden's sister.
Yes.
Used to date Herzog.
Yes. And like they had a fling.
Still.
Right. And that's why, you know, I was saying that her sister says she would have gone in a car with him because, you know, he was like a really close family friend. She trusted him. She would, it wouldn't be surprising if her sister got in a car with him.
Damn it. Golly.
And so the sister also has, feels guilt about that. So, yeah. Prosecuting attorney, his name was Testa. He told jurors that over the years, Shermantine had bragged to relatives and acquaintances that he had made people disappear. In a confrontation that he had with a woman at a trailer park, he said, "I have buried people here. Listen to the heartbeats of the people I've buried here. Listen to the heartbeats of families I've buried here."
Okay. This is not a large area.
Well, Stockton's kind of big. Stockton's got like 350,000 people.
Right. Right. Now.
Back then. Well, yeah. Now I don't know what it had back then. I didn't check that.
But I mean, he seems to kind of run in the same circles, like with the same people.
Yeah.
Not like he, so, I mean, he probably said these things. I mean, first of all, if he's saying to his family and he's saying those types of things to his family.
Some of the people who testified were his family, by the way, which I kind of left off some of that testimony. But yeah.
But here's the thing. If a family member of mine repeated on multiple occasions how he's hidden people and how he's killed people, I would start, I'm like, okay, well, either he's batshit crazy or there's some truth to this and someone might want to call some, you know, hey, you might want to check out this guy just in case. I could be wrong. He could be just full of shit, but, you know, would you mind checking out his batshit crazy ass?
Right. Well, look at his mom. I mean, we know what they've done.
Exactly.
And his sister, he raped his sister when she was 12. In addition to those witnesses, the prosecuting attorney also called the bartender to the stand, and she was bartending that night, and she said that the two men were drinking shots of alcohol and beer, and then Vanderhyden arrived around midnight. She said that Shermantine was wired on meth and most of the night, and that the alcohol did not seem to faze him at all. She also testified that she saw him with a small plastic baggie of meth. He had it out and then he stuffed it in a cigarette pack. She said that at closing time, she saw Herzog in front of the bar working on his motorcycle and he told her it wouldn't start. And she said, "I asked him if he needed any help and he said no. So I closed the front door and locked it." So I'm not real sure why that testimony was important. I just threw it in there because I don't have an idea why. The defense did not have much. They did call some people to the stand, but basically, their defense strategy was to say Herzog's the one that did it all. He's trying to blame Shermantine. Shermantine didn't do it. Herzog did it all. They're blaming each other. They said that Herzog had a key to the cabin when Wheeler went missing, and Herzog knew the roads and wells just as much as Shermantine did. Herzog's the guilty one, not Shermantine. And the jury didn't give a shit because, see, a first-degree murder, Cindy Vanderhyden, Chevelle Wheeler, Paul Cavanaugh, and Howard King. The DNA evidence was enough to convince the jury of his guilt, even though the two bodies had not been found. They recommended a sentence of death for him.
Good.
And yeah, the judge agreed. So he got the death penalty. Then his buddy, his BFF, had a trial. His trial came next, and he was also found guilty of 3 counts of murder and 1 count of being an accessory to murder. He was only given 78 years. They're both guilty. They're both in prison. But then in August 2004, to the horror of the victims' families and to the citizens of San Joaquin County, Herzog's conviction was thrown out.
Shut the front door.
Yep. So that's where I'm going to stop until next week. So
17-hour.
That's a part of, yes, 17-hour interrogation. So be sure to tune in next week for the rest of this crazy ass story because it's not over.
Thank you so much.
Hey,
for listening welcome. To, well, thank you, Mercedes. And thank you, audience, for listening to this week's murder or continuation of murders. We appreciate sharing our passion with you and we thank you for your support. If you'd like to support us even further, please consider subscribing to our podcast and giving us a 5-star rating and a comment. Your subscription and ratings are essential to our success. You can do this by finding us on your favorite platform. For more information and links to our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages, please visit our website at itwasn'tmetruecrime.com.
We are so grateful to spend our time together to share murder stories with you. Thank you so much for your support. Please recommend It Wasn't Me to your true crime loving friends and family. And thank you to our Patreon supporters. You are the extra. You too can become one of our beloved patrons by signing up at patreon.com/itwasn'tmepod. Thanks again, guys. And remember, it wasn't me.